From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with William Grider, political reporter for Rolling Stone magazine. His new book, Secrets of the Temple, compares the men who control America's money supply to priests presiding over mysterious religion. Also today, I talk with our television critic David Bianculli. It's another in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's commentators. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc recording of Gerard Schwartz and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra performing music of Haydn. And Jan-Harald Brunvand joins us with his latest urban legend about a stolen package whose contents horrify the thieves that took it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is journalist William Grider. He's the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine and the former assistant managing editor at the Washington Post. Grider is very good at getting officials to speak candidly. In 1981, he wrote the controversial story about David Stockman, in which the budget director revealed his cynicism about his own supply-side economics policies. Grider's new book is about a public institution which he says decides the largest questions of the economy, including who shall prosper and who shall fail. Yet its role remains opaque and mysterious. And, Grider says, this institution is shielded from scrutiny partly by its own official secrecy, but also by the curious ignorance of the American public. Grider's new book is a study of the Federal Reserve. The Fed was created in 1913 to protect the banking system from periodic money flow crises and temporary shortages of money that could lead to bank failure. The Fed has the power to raise or lower interest rates and to print money. But as to how the Federal Reserve Board does what it does and why, well, who understands it? Grider compares it to priests working in a secret temple. In fact, he titled his new book, The Secrets of the Temple. He told me how the Federal Reserve resembles a temple.
On many levels. First, it inherits what was a religious function in ancient civilizations, that is the creation of money. And it's not a coincidence that that was done in temples in Babylonia and Rome and lots of other places, because there's an act of social faith implicit in money that has to be sanctified. If we don't believe in it, it's just pieces of paper. The Fed is in all respects a rationalistic scientific institution that presumably is working out mathematical equations in the most sober manner. Nevertheless, it is not a coincidence that it cloaks itself in mystique and secrecy and the trappings of some mysterious authority, because it's the protector of that process, which is very difficult to elaborate in rationalistic terms in a direct democratic manner.
Now, it's interesting. You're describing the Fed as this temple where the high priests cloak themselves in secrecy. But I think to most of us who aren't in the financial world, that the Fed is this big institution that's kind of incomprehensible and rather boring. How many of us, when we hear a news story about the Federal Reserve Bank, just tune out? And, you know, and don't even know what the story is about. And that seems to me like a contradiction, you know. Do you think it is? This on the one hand, that it's this mysterious temple. On the other hand, that it's boring and incomprehensible to most people.
Well, I'm basically trying to smash that contradiction in the book, because, in fact, the Fed is one of the two central levers in how the government manages the economy. The bromide managing the money supply is really a euphemism for manipulating interest rates. The power to manipulate interest rates is like a wand that can sweep across the whole economy in the most intimate fashion, change everybody's behavior, sometimes quite quickly, make some people prosper and other people fail. And when you begin to talk in those terms, then people get a glimmer of why this is not boring and why they ought to have some sense of what's going on there.
Let's get down to it. What does the Federal Reserve Bank actually do? What is its function?
Well, it's ostensibly to regulate the value of money That is, prevent inflation and prevent deflation. That requires a series of sort of prophecies about where the future is going, not unlike ancient temple priests. And although it makes those prophecies in scientific terms, there's also a lot of hunch and wishful thinking and fear among the Federal Reserve governors. Then they cast forward their own effects on the future, in the simple terms, through interest rates. And indeed, they sometimes have the power to fulfill their own prophecies. Ultimately, once you get a grasp of what that process is and the arguments they themselves have over it, you realize that what the Fed is really doing is making deep choices about public values. And that could be what the public really needs now, what this society really needs now is lower unemployment and faster economic growth. Or, more typically, it's the reverse. Everybody is having a good time, but we think, casting off into the future, that this society needs to slow down. And so that means higher unemployment and slower economic growth and more bankruptcies, et cetera.
So the Federal Reserve Bank's two main tools are controlling the interest rates and controlling the flow of money, printing new money or not printing new money.
Right.
So it basically controls the price of money. Now, the Federal Reserve Bank is supposed to be politically and ideologically neutral, but you don't think that it really is.
No.
Whose interest do you think the Federal Reserve Bank represents?
Well, I think from the very beginning, and it was not as well recognized until later decades, the Fed was created as this disinterested technical agency that would simply make the credit system work more smoothly by occasionally injecting or withdrawing more money. The problem is that that is the power to do all these things I've mentioned, to really to steer the economy. And over a period of years, as they discover that, it becomes a focal point for a kind of implicit politics that's not argued out in campaigns mostly, but goes on constantly among the different interests, trying to push it and pull it one way or the other. By its nature, the Fed lies closest in the society to the financial system and especially to the commercial banks who are members of the Federal Reserve System, who put their reserves there, to the brokerages, to the bond market. The values of those sectors of interests lie very close to the Federal Reserves, and the highest value of all is stable money. That they want hard dollars. If that requires high interest rates, so be it. That means benefits to the creditor classes as well. I try to describe in the book a kind of fault line in our society, which doesn't get talked about much in politics, but it gives you some sense of where the battle lies. If you ask who owns financial wealth, financial assets, anywhere from a checking account, savings account, to bank CDs, government bonds, so forth, a Fed study itself spelled it out pretty clearly. 85% of the net financial wealth held by individuals is owned by 10% of the people. 55% of the public are in fact net debtors. They've got a checking account perhaps, or maybe even a savings account, but when you figure in their debts, they're either at the waterline or underneath it in terms of wealth. That, in a very crude way, describes the fulcrum that the Fed swings back and forth on. And they don't ever talk about that explicitly inside the Federal Reserve at the board meetings, but they know that that's the tension in what they're doing.
So you mean a policy can either benefit the people who loan money or benefit the people who owe money?
Exactly.
Let's look at a recent disaster in the American economy, the recent stock market crash. Do you think that any Federal Reserve policies helped make that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a popular argument, but I think historians will agree that the Fed is centrally implicated in the stock market crash, and principally because it imposed single-mindedly these hard money values during the 1980s, and that suppresses the real economy of producers and workers, gives a smaller return on them. It obviously enhances the return on financial assets because if you've got a higher interest rate, you get a bigger return in the financial markets. So the financial markets have a great run in the 1980s and the investors in finance. That draws more and more people to put their money in paper rather than in farmland or oil wells or all the other alternatives. That in turn leads to the run-up of speculation, which blew off October 19th. The values in the stock market diverge from reality. They keep going up higher and higher, where the real economy, the corporations that those stocks presumably represent, is bumping along at a very mediocre pace. The Fed knew that was happening, anguished over it, wished to stop it, but basically did not act. And I say that well aware that once it had taken off, it's not easy to stop.
Now, one point that you bring up in your book is that usually there's an orthodoxy, an economic orthodoxy that prevails, and it's not until a calamity occurs that people question the prevailing wisdom of that orthodoxy and a new theory comes along to replace it. Do you see that happening now? Do you think that the recent stock market crash was that kind of calamity that's going to uproot the prevailing orthodoxy?
I think it was, and I've said that and written that in recent months, and a lot of people roll their eyes. I think it takes a while, sometimes quite a while, like years, before people are willing to recognize that they're living in a new world. I think the stock market crash was such a watershed. 5 or 10 years from now, we will look back on that moment and realize that that's when the illusions ended. And I say that because reading American economic history over really two centuries, you see that pattern again and again where economics, yes, has scientific premises, but economists and economic opinion acts very much like a market where people gather around what looks like the hot idea and the majority bows to it and subscribes to it, and then suddenly events contradict it in an often very powerful way. And there's a kind of shattering effect and a vacuum that follows that. And then you hear all kinds of marginal, eccentric voices come up and say, hey, this is what was wrong. And conventional opinion finds it very difficult to say, hey, you know, he's right.
If you think that the stock market crash is going to uproot the prevailing orthodoxy, let me ask you briefly to describe what you think that orthodoxy is that's going to be uprooted.
Well, it's the central principle of it is a laissez-faire conservatism, which says the government ought to get out of markets, whether they're financial or other kinds, and let the spirit of free enterprise carry us forward. And that's a very appealing idea, which about half of which I subscribe to myself. But the history demonstrates, particularly in finance, that when you create that arena where the government has stepped aside, there are no controls, there are no limits, the markets tend sooner or later to spin out of control. And that's part of what happened October 19th. But it's also what happened more generally in our economy through the 1980s. And we took the limits off interest rates. And what we got were the highest interest rates in this century, first. And secondly, a landscape overburdened with debt. I mean, what we discovered is that people still borrow the money even though it's 15 or 16%, even though they can't afford it, even though they're going to be bankrupted by making that loan. What does that tell us? It tells us we've got to return to the re-regulation of finance, not just to prevent usury, but because the economy can't function without some limits. And that's a kind of interventionist approach, which is still quite unpopular, and I expect it will remain unpopular for a while yet, But I think we'll find ourselves back there in a couple of years.
Let me ask you briefly. You've told us that you think that the Federal Reserve represents the interests of the financial world. Would you like to see certain reforms at the Fed?
Yeah, I think, you know, people tinker with little things here and there in how the Fed operates, trying to get a balance or a more balanced behavior from the Fed. But I'm not questioning the earnestness or the public-spirited behavior of the people there. I think just the nature of the institution guarantees that it's going to incline toward finance. That's just the nature of the animal. And that's been true repeatedly throughout its history. So I think you basically have to do a fundamental reform and make, not abolish the Fed as a institution, but make it politically accountable. And that means ending its independent status. I think you'd get out of that a kind of level playing field, as the bankers like to say, where all of the political interests, from home builders to oil drillers to farmers to manufacturing to bankers and brokers, would have a more equal access to the policy debate. And that doesn't mean the results would be infallible or that they wouldn't occasionally indulge in folly and error, but it would be – you'd get more balance on both sides, I think.
My guest is William Grider. He's the author of the new book, Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. He's also the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. We're going to talk some more about his journalism after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist William Grider is my guest. His new book is titled Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. You know, I want to talk about the journalism that you've done over the years, and I think perhaps the story that you became best known for was your story on David Stockman, the former budget director under President Reagan in Reagan's first term. And you had a cover story in the Atlantic magazine and then a book about Stockman called The Education of David Stockman. And some of the things that he said actually reminds me of things that you're saying now about the Federal Reserve. What I mean is that Stockman, in talking about supply-side economics to you, said the whole thing is premised on faith, on a belief about how the world works. And that's what you're saying about how we deal with money and how the Federal Reserve deals with money. Is there a connection?
Yeah, I think, what I'm trying to suggest in the book, and I'm sure it will offend many economists, but I really believe it. Economics theories, rules, etc., are really science hiding in front of religion. And if you really look more deeply at what people are doing when they argue economics, they are arguing from deep premises of faith. A liberal will start from one set of assumptions about human nature and the divine, and a conservative will start from a completely different set. And that's, you know, there's nothing scandalous about that. That's the way we are. But I guess one of my perverse habits as a reporter is to kind of lift the curtain every once in a while and say, wait a minute. These presumptions of certainty are founded on sort of human beliefs, and we all know kind of what they are.
It is very, very difficult to get someone involved in politics, whether it's an elected or an appointed position, to talk openly about what they do and why they do it and what the real beliefs are that their actions follow from. Now, you really, in your piece about Stockman, got him to talk very candidly about how he was losing faith in supply-side economics in the political system he worked in and how supply-side economics was really a trickle-down theory, but no one would buy the trickle-down theory anymore. Now, I'd really like to know about how you spoke with him over the months. I know your story on him was based on months of talking with him. Were those confessions that he made based on you making a really aggressive, virtuoso question, or did that just kind of emerge over time?
No, I think, you know, people got a lot of strange ideas about that transaction after the fact. But mostly it was a reporter interviewing a government official. If you read the transcripts of those interviews, very seldom did I go off into the blue with my own philosophical ramblings on the nature of government or anything else. Mostly I was asking very simple, albeit well-informed questions like, what happened this week? Why did it happen? What did you say? What did the president say? And then, as the script developed, I had a huge advantage. I had this transcript which I could read and see that in January he said X was going to happen, and here it was March, and the reverse had happened. So I could go back to him and say, "Well, David, you told me that the markets were going to do this when they saw your budget, and instead they went the other way. What's your explanation for that?" And that builds up a kind of leverage which reporters don't always have, where I could sort of take his own words and throw them back at him and say, explain yourself.
Well, exactly, and this seems to me like the kind of thing that you can't do on a daily story that you're reporting on for a newspaper, but something that you can do if you're reporting over time for an extended piece in a magazine or for a book that you're doing.
It's much harder to do on a daily basis, no question. I think the technique is still applicable if you're willing to do the work to have a memory of where we came from. I mean, and one of my raps on the news media generally is, A, it has no memory. It forgets what somebody said 3 months ago or 6 months ago, and that's not that difficult to keep a running log of that in your mind. And B, which is worse, it's not interested in what happened last week or the week before or 2 months ago. If you look at the front page of most of the so-called important newspapers, half of the stories will be about the future. They will be somebody saying, well, what's going to happen next month is blah, 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 or some candidate promising this in the future or a forecast story or whatever. And what I did in both Stockman and in the book on the Fed is simply cast backward, which is what reporters can do well, right? We're not that good at predicting the future, but we can find out what happened.
When someone is telling you something that you really didn't think that they would admit to, like, for instance, Stockman admitting that supply-side economics is really trickled down, do you try to not let a reaction show? Do you try to not let your eyes say, like, oh, boy, he's making a big confession. Yeah. This will be great. I can't believe he's telling me that. Do you try not to betray that?
Yeah, I would say generally, yes, but I don't know whether people will understand this or not, but what I try to do interviewing, and you have to, I think it makes you more effective, is sort of throw away your own ego. You are, after all, asking these people to give you information, and that's the only purpose of the transaction that matters to you. It does not matter to you whether this person respects you as being particularly smart and sophisticated, or does not matter whether you have sort of won the human contest of egos going on. It does, in fact, it probably contradicts your purpose if you play that sort of game. So when I interview, I don't care who it is, I want to pull down my own reactions, my own sophistication, whatever, and do whatever I can to elicit responses. And I'll give you one example. With Stockman, with the governors of the Federal Reserve Board, whoever they were, it was a very basic technique. I would ask them a question. They would give me an answer that was perhaps garbed in economic jargon, and I would say, I'm sorry, I don't understand that. And maybe I really didn't understand it, but at least I would say, can you run through that again? I didn't quite get what you mean. And it's a human response when somebody says that to you to go through it again and say what you're really thinking more clearly and forcefully. And it's a very simple technique, but a lot of reporters get their own egos wrapped up in the process of interviewing.
Oh, and you're embarrassed to admit
and
that
you're
you don't
embarrassed
understand
to admit it. That you didn't understand. And that's what I mean by throw away your ego. It doesn't matter whether you look like a fool or not, as long as you're getting the people to open up.
Let me ask you, you're affiliated with Rolling Stone now, and you're writing a newspaper where some of the political writing was done by Hunter Thompson, whose legacy is, you know, gonzo journalism, right, getting really drunk and writing very first-person kinds of accounts. How did you feel walking into a magazine with that kind of reputation? You were coming from the Washington Post.
Yeah, well, it was weird. and it was especially weird to all my friends and colleagues at the Post. I think they thought I'd sort of flipped out or something. It was very exhilarating. And you know, people who read the magazine know that it's not gonzo anymore. That era ended, and there's a lot of understandable sort of nostalgia for what was lost, but I think it's kind of silly to presume that you can go on acting like it's the early 70s, whether you're Rolling Stone or nobody else in the society is acting that way anymore. In fact, the reporting qualities of the magazine now are quite rigorous, unlike the early 70s.
We're just about out of time, so let me ask you briefly. You have been reporting for many years. I know a lot of reporters who report into maybe their 30s, and once they reach their late 30s or early 40s, they're out, and they're either going to get an editing job, a public relations job, or change professions altogether, maybe write a novel. But they don't stay with reporting. A lot of reporters don't stay with it very long. What's kept you in reporting?
That's a good question. I was at the Post for a lot of years as a reporter and loved it, and they were very good to me, and I had great fun. And then through a series of kind of chance events, they tapped me for management, and I was an assistant managing editor for National Affairs for 3 years, which is a very tough job. I enjoyed doing it. I learned enormously from it. But I thought, you know, basically they want me to be a grown-up and do adult things. And I said, I'd rather not do that. I'd rather stay young, at least in my mind. Reporting is what I do best. It's a lot of fun. It's hard work if you do it honestly, but it kind of feeds on a kind of almost pre-adolescent curiosity about life, and it's human nature. And I've seen this all through the newspaper business. Some people reach a point in life, as you describe, 35, 45, where it's not that they're tired or anything else. It's just that their curiosity takes them in a different direction. And others of us, as long as our legs hold up, enjoy doing that. I mean, there's nothing profound about it or grandiose. It's just a lot of fun to go out and knock on doors, see the rest of the country. And I think as long as my legs hold up, I will have the juice to do that.
Well, William Grotter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been journalist William Grotter. His new book is titled Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. He's also the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński. He's a former foreign correspondent for the Polish Press Agency. His books include The Emperor, about Haile Selassie, and Shah of Shahs, about the Shah of Iran. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Fresh Air's television critic, David Bianculli. It's the latest in our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. We'll find out how David's watched TV day in and day out for 13 years and still kept his sanity. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of music by Haydn, performed by the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Gerard Schwartz. And if the latest urban legend is any indication, thieves should be thinking twice before stealing packages out of cars. Jan Harald Brunven tells us the story about the package containing the dead cat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. President Reagan today made another pitch for additional aid for the Nicaraguan rebels. The president called next month's congressional consideration of Contra funding a make-or-break vote for the freedom fighters. Mr. Reagan said Nicaragua's recent moves to comply with the Guatemala peace accord were brought about by Contra military efforts. Earlier today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater denied charges that the administration does not want peace in Central America. He called the claim by Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd outrageous. The United States today added North Korea to its list of countries that support terrorism. The action was based primarily on North Korea's involvement in the bombing of a South Korean jetliner last November in which 115 people died. State Department spokesman Charles Redman announced that America's already limited contacts with North Korea would be cut back even further.
The practical economic effects for North Korea are limited, since there is only a small amount of U.S. trade with that country. And most of that is already controlled under the Trading with the Enemy Act. However, designation is an important symbolic act, for it emphasizes, by formal listing, our conviction that North Korea supports terrorism.
North Korea's addition to the list of terrorist states will mean additional restrictions on U.S. trade. The U.S. list also includes Iran, Libya, Syria, Cuba, and South Yemen. The crash of a B-1 bomber 4 months ago was probably caused by a single bird, not a flock of birds as was originally thought. Today, the Air Force released results of its investigation of last September's crash during a practiced low-level bombing mission. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Air Force investigators say the bird was probably a pelican weighing 15 to 20 pounds. The accident occurred while the bomber was flying more than 600 miles per hour, about 600 feet off the ground. The bird penetrated the right wing near an engine, rupturing hydraulic and fuel lines, which caused a fire and loss of control. Officials say the B-1 was designed and tested to deal with birds weighing 5 to 6 pounds, but collisions by larger birds was not anticipated. The bombers are now being modified to offer more protection. 3 crew members survived by bailing out, but 3 others went down with the plane. The Air Force report says one of the deaths was due to a faulty ejection seat. That problem, too, officials say, is being corrected. The modifications will cost $62 million. The B-1's primary mission involves low-level attack to avoid detection by Soviet air defenses. But such training was halted following the bird strike. The Air Force expects to resume low-level flights beginning in the spring. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Inflation in 1987 rose to nearly 4.5%, 4 times the rate of the previous year. The Labor Department reports the Consumer Price Index for December rose 0.1%. Most analysts seem unconcerned about last year's huge jump in consumer prices. They say, in general, the inflation rate appears to be stable. The Commerce Department said today construction starts on new homes fell sharply last month. New starts dropped more than 16% from November's level, the steepest decline in almost 4 years. Economist Lyle Gramley of the Mortgage Bankers Association says the figures aren't as bad as they look.
The decline is primarily in the units with dwellings with 5 or more units, which declined 37%. And they are extremely volatile. November had been unusually high, and when you average November and December together, you get a figure that looks fairly reasonable. So surprised, yes, but dismayed, no.
Other economists, however, are less optimistic. For the second straight day, stock prices took a big drop on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 57 points to close at 1879.14. Decline led advances about 4-1 on volume of 182 million shares. In Washington, I'm Sharon Green.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of one of two new Haydn recordings on the Delos label. The conductor is Gerard Schwartz, no relation to Lloyd, and the record features a more varied selection than you usually find on such a record.
One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons is the one with the two performing seals. One has a big beach ball, the other is standing in front of a set of horns. The one with the horns is saying to the one with the ball, "Of course, what I really want to do is direct." One shouldn't be too cynical. Sometimes it's hard to know where our talents, if any, really lie. Why shouldn't a performer who has suffered under the thumb of terrible directors prefer to do the directing? In fact, many conductors, including Toscanini and Koussevitzky, started out as instrumentalists. Gerard Schwartz was a trumpet virtuoso before he turned to conducting, and his career as a conductor is certainly taking off. Recently, he's had recordings released with symphony orchestras from Seattle to London. He's a very musical director. There's nothing vulgar or stupid about what he does. But everything he does seems a little square. There's neither much insight nor individuality, no rhythmic snap. It's as if he wants everything to sound like the standard version. Not that this is the worst ambition in the world. Recordings like his are often useful to introduce listeners to a given work, to all the notes, to the general style. But what they can't or don't want to show you are the subtleties, the jokes, the nooks and crannies, the quirks and ticks that make great composers different from everyone else. Conservative conductors like Schwartz tend to avoid extremes, to iron out tempos and smooth over transitions. Nothing too controversial. That's what happens on this new Haydn recording with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra on the Delos label. Let's hear some of the Andante of the 104th Symphony, the last symphonic slow movement Haydn wrote. It's nice, bouncy, charming. Now here's the same passage on an old recording by Sir Thomas Beecham with the Royal Philharmonic. Mitchum shows us the profundity of this music, the exquisite melancholy. It's not just that the tempo is slower, though that's part of it. There's a spiritual difference, a different level of seriousness with which the music is taken. Schwartz's temperament may not make for a particularly stimulating or revealing symphony conductor, but it actually can make a good, unobtrusive accompanist. Delos has begun an interesting experiment. In addition to discs that include only symphonies or piano concertos or cello concertos, they also have a series that offers a program of what we might listen to at an actual concert. Two symphonies, with a concerto in between. On this disc, between Haydn's early Symphony No. 22, The Philosopher, and his late 104th, comes the familiar D major harpsichord concerto, No. 2, played here on a Bösendorfer piano by Carol Rosenberger. It's a delight from beginning to end. Rosenberger's the more imaginative musician, and Schwartz's conventionality is a good foil for her special loveliness.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a new Haydn recording on the Delos label, featuring Gerard Schwartz with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and pianist Carol Rosenberger. Listening to Fresh Air. From time to time, we're featuring interviews with our regular contributors who comment on television, music, books, films, and social trends. Today we talk with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. He's always loved television and considers himself lucky to be writing about it. In his 13 years as a TV critic, he's written for the Gainesville Sun, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and currently the New York Post. David told me which TV shows had the greatest impact on him when he was growing up.
Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, oddly enough. The Prisoner, the Nixon-Kennedy debates, and Rocky and Bullwinkle, I think, are the four big ones. I've never actually tried to put the list together, but that's pretty close.
Why the Nixon-Kennedy debates? Rocky and Bullwinkle.
There's no problem. Well, actually, it was probably Rocky and Bullwinkle without the animation. My parents were Kennedy freaks, and so this is like I'm 7 years old. And watching the whole political process without any real idea that there even was an existing president. But to watch that whole process and then the political conventions and everything like that, it probably introduced me to TV and the way that that works so much earlier than anything else would have in a serious way that I remember even as a little kid thinking this is really something.
I always figured that as a kid you probably spent a lot of time watching television.
I knew that. See, this is the reason I was worried about actually talking to you about this, because I know
it's going to all come
out. Yeah, I mean, it's like it really sounds like definitive nerd, when actually the truth of the matter is I was a pretty normal kid, and only as I get older am I defining myself in nerd terms. But I didn't watch all that much TV, but I really did like what I saw. I mean, the earliest existing pieces of writing of mine is all TV related. My first diary, you know, when I was 7 years old, is full of being upset because they took a show off, or how much I loved this cartoon, or, you know, The Wizard of Oz was on tonight. Those were big events in my life.
When I was growing up, my parents had this rule that basically you could watch TV, but not weekday afternoon TV. Like when you came home from school, you don't watch it because...
Oh, you had better parents than I did.
Yeah, they really didn't. They didn't like the soaps and the game shows and really tried to discourage us from watching them. Did your parents have any rules, restrictive rules about what you could and couldn't watch?
None. Absolutely none. I didn't watch all that much, really. And it's very odd when I think about TV. Maybe the reason that I like it as a medium is because when I was in my tough teen years, I related to my father through television. In other words, we would gravitate towards the same shows. And when you're watching things like Smothers Brothers, which is very politically slippy, you know, in the late 60s, and your father is watching it with you and you discuss it every week, that's a really nice thing that TV is doing. I mean, seriously, the Smothers Brothers were pretty subversive back then. I mean, beautifully so.
It's interesting that television actually brought you and your helped bring you and your father together, as opposed to
and with Vietnam as well. I mean, the news reports. I mean, it may have polarized a lot of families in the opposite extreme, but my father became, you know, just as outraged about Vietnam and all of the situation and everything that was going on with Watergate as I was through TV.
I'm always interested when someone grows up with a certain interest or passion that adults are supposed to discourage them from, like television. But as they grow up, it turns out that they had a good reason for liking this, and they're going to turn it into their profession, as you did. When did you start thinking seriously about writing about television?
Well, I'd always done, you know, I'd done high school paper stuff, but that was music criticism. And then,
what kind of music? Rock and roll?
Rock and roll. And then I did an underground newspaper, and that was mostly politics and rock and roll. And then I went to college, and I'd gone to college with the intention of teaching, teaching journalism and English. And in my last journalism course, when they assigned me to the local newspaper, I just sort of fell into the feature department, which had nothing for me to do that day. And it was the premiere of Saturday Night Live. And so I said, can I write about this show? And so they let me do it, and they liked what I had written so much, they gave me four more, and then that turned into a column. And then I stayed for a master's, and by the time I was through, I'd already been a TV critic for 2 years. And then I went out into the real world of journalism, but I didn't expect to be able to be a TV critic. I was, you know, applying for all sorts of different jobs in journalism, but a TV critic's job came up.
Someone I know who is a television researcher once told me that he found that whenever people were telling him about something they saw on TV last night, it would always be preceded by an apology, like, I happened to be at my friend's house the other night, and they had the TV on, so I happened to see.
Yeah, William F. Buckley was a repeater. I pressed the microwave, and all of a sudden, Gilligan's Island, you know. Yes.
No one will admit to watching television unless it's public television, and then they feel like, well, there's a badge of honor attached to that.
It's true.
Is that true?
Yeah, and it's really funny, because that is one thing that I will make fun of people for. The amazing thing to me is, like, I do not like going to parties, but when I go, it is so easy to be conversational, because as soon as somebody finds out what I do, everybody, like, lines up and takes tickets to tell me about 30-something and they hate this or they love this, and you can just steer the conversation. Nobody watches it, but everybody watches it.
Since the time that you became a television critic, home video cassette recorders have become very accessible.
Right.
How have their existence changed your job? Because now you can screen things at home.
Oh, it's completely changed the way I do my job. I mean, it's great now. When I started, I mean, I bought one of the first video cassette recorders just so I could go out at night. Now, everything, I am working now solely out of my house. And all the tapes come to my house for every show that is done. And then I've got like a bank of six TVs to cover when there's breaking news or when there's another judicial appointment or something, and watch everything at once. But anybody could be a TV critic now from their house, assuming that they can talk everybody into sending all the tapes to them. That's the only catch.
I think it sounds like a great setup.
Yeah, it really is nice. I don't know how long I'll be able to pull it off, but I'm having a good time.
So what's an example of the kind of occasion where all the sets are running?
Well, for the most recent, the Gorbachev, that whole week, you had, you know, Gorbachev's arrival coming on, and all of that was, what is CNN doing, what is CBS doing, NBC, ABC, and you have to watch them all at once, PBS, to say, like, for example, ABC was the only network the first time that Gorbachev spoke to use simultaneous translation, not to wait for the official translator that Gorbachev had brought with him. And so they had like a millisecond jump on everybody else, which sounds great, except that the translators didn't often translate using the same words, which is kind of risky.
I have a friend who would like to live in Philadelphia, but he's a filmmaker and wants to see everything on cable. So we moved to a distant suburb that he really doesn't especially want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
But they have cable in Philadelphia, doesn't?
Right.
Have you had to, like, live in places
exactly
that have
You're
cable?
You're the first person that's ever asked me that. I mean, real estate agents, you talk about really getting, you know, the first question that I ask is not like, you know, how good's the school district or, you know, exactly what's the resale value? It's, you know, what cable does this have and how many pay stations? And I actually had one real estate agent call from using her like hot phone in her car to call the cable company and find out if this particular street was wired.
Is there a kind of television criticism that you really hate?
I hate the stuff that's 80% synopsis and 20%, can I say bitchiness on the radio?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, where you know the formula stuff where it's two paragraphs into the lead and then here is exactly what happens from start to finish in this show and then and that's it 6 days a week or 5 days a week for the entire year. And there's an awful lot of that. I think that, as a matter of fact, that those are the ones that get a lot of the jobs.
Why is that?
Because I think editors are still looking for the same people they were looking for when TV came in and it was a threat. They want people who look down on TV because those are who they see are critics. I don't even know if this works in other fields. I don't think they expect classical music critics, you know, to love punk rock. I don't think they expect, you know, film critics to hate movies. But I do think that they look for people to make fun of TV in the job interviews and then do it in the jobs. It's really kind of sad.
But you're different. You actually like TV.
I like TV. I mean, I hate as much of bad TV as everybody else, and I hate it more because I have to watch a lot of it. I mean, I have to watch every show once. I mean, that's an awful thing. That could straighten out prison systems real fast. But I don't have to watch it twice, and I get to tell people about the good stuff, and I get to go back to the good stuff. And, I mean, I do get enthusiastic about TV. This is where I worry about being nerdy, is I haven't burned out. It's been 13 years of a job that really does take an awful lot of time to do and do right, but I keep on being enthusiastic about it.
Well, David, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks. This was enthusiastic, too. Maybe radio is the thing.
Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we'll have some reports on U.S. policy to aid the Contras and what Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut has to say about what the White House had to say about him today. Also, we'll talk with a writer who's written a guide to children's books for the parents of children who read children's books, a new dictionary of economics, and a report about a house that's for sale. It is reputed to be the largest house in America. Any idea where it is?
Well, maybe it's a converted skyscraper. I'll guess Manhattan.
No, not too far off, though. It's in Huntington, Long Island. It is the Otto Kahn Castle, for sale for a mere $52 million.
Hey, sounds good. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've ever had something stolen, you have probably fantasized about taking revenge. Urban legend expert Jan Harald Brunvand joins us with some stories about thieves who get what they deserve.
Here in Salt Lake City, where I live, an apocryphal story is told as if it's true. Possibly it's told where you live as well. The story takes off by word of mouth in response to people's concern about thieves stealing packages out of parked cars. This time the thief gets a nasty shock. Usually a woman who is a friend of the storyteller is supposed to have been driving on icy streets to a local shopping mall to exchange a present. She accidentally strikes and kills a cat. Not wanting to leave it there, the woman scrapes up the cat's body as best she can and transfers it to the plastic bag in which her goods for exchange are being carried. The logo on the bag belongs to a pricey department store. She leaves this plastic bag in her car with one window half open, and she heads into the mall to make the exchange. But looking back from across the parking lot, she sees an elderly woman reach into the car and steal the bag. So the friend of the friend supposedly follows this catnabber into the mall, watching to see what will happen. The old woman goes into a cafe, orders a cup of coffee, and then reaches into the bag to see what kind of loot she's picked up. When she feels the furry little corpse in the bag, she screams and faints. Paramedics are called, and they're just carrying the woman away in a stretcher when a helpful waitress at the cafe decides to reunite the old woman with what she thinks is her property. "Oh, you forgot her package," she says, putting the plastic bag under the unconscious woman's chest. Just then, the elderly thief starts to revive, and she opens her eyes and looks straight into the dead cat's face. Then she screams and faints again. This story has, I might say, dogged my footsteps for some 30 years. I first noted it when I was a graduate student at Indiana University. The story showed up in a 1959 newspaper column from Bloomington, Indiana, and was supposed to have happened in a department store in Indianapolis. But I found earlier versions, with locales ranging from the West Coast and Washington, D.C., to Europe. Someone recently sent me a clipping from a Norwegian newspaper claiming the same episode happened there. The headline was, "Stål plastpusse med død katt. Stolen plastic bag contains dead cat." One variation on the theme says an apartment dweller's pet cat died of old age. The pet owner asks a friend in the suburbs to meet her in a downtown department store and take the dead cat, which she's wrapped in a package, home to bury it in her garden. But the package is stolen by a little old lady who later faints on the sidewalk outside the store, the open package by her side. In another version of this story, which I've traced to the first decade of this century, a person is going from place to place trying to dispose of the cat package by accidentally leaving it behind. But he's consistently foiled by some well-meaning bystander who reminds him to take his package. The person eventually gives up and goes home. There he opens the package again, only to discover that inside there's a ham or some steaks instead of the cat. The essential problem in all versions of the legend is keeping track of a corpse, which links this story to the legend about a family's disastrous trip to Mexico that ends when the grandmother dies. Her family tries to transport the body back home, tied to their car roof, but when they stop for a meal, the car, with grandmother on top, is stolen. The consistent theme of these stories is that the thief merely gets what he or she deserves. The story may not be true, but it certainly contains a bit of poetic justice.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with actor Joe Mantegna. He stars as the mysterious con man in the film House of Games, written and directed by David Mamet. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the soundtrack for the movie Less Than Zero. Although the movie flopped, the soundtrack continues to produce hits. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Moonstruck, starring Cher and Nicolas Cage. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Joyce Lieberman engineers the show. Chris Spurgeon directs it. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.